Chapter 3. The rest is up to you. The line dividing work and leisure time is blurring right before our eyes, and it's creating a phenomenon called leisure time. Dalton Conley. Recently, I suffered a relapse in my 14-year battle with a major addiction. No, my setback didn't cost me the pastorate or cause my family to leave me, at least not yet. And it's probably not what you think. I'm not addicted to drugs or alcohol or pornography or gambling, but what I battle has the potential to be just as destructive as any of those. Honestly, it could even be more destructive because typically there's no intervention for it. I'm addicted to adrenaline. You might wonder how I know I'm addicted to this all-natural drug. Simple. I spent $90 for 2 one-hour sessions with a trained counseling professional for this diagnosis. Ironically enough, I didn't even want to be there. After all, I didn't think I had a problem. But the leaders at the church where I was serving at the time thought I was dangerously close to workaholic burnout, so to appease them, I went. At the end of my second session, the counselor gave me an assignment. "This week," he said, peering over his notepad dramatically, "I want you to sit still for 5 minutes." And I'm not going to lie to you. I took a good hard look at the guy and thought, "You've got to be kidding me. This is the worst $90 I've ever spent." "5 minutes of non-productivity," he restated. "You can't pray. You can't plan. You can't problem solve. You have to do N-O-T-H-I-N-G. "Easy," I snapped. "No problem." But deep down inside my productivity-loving heart, I knew it would be a problem. Why sit around wasting time, right? I mean, what in the world could be accomplished by staring out the window for 5 minutes? Nevertheless, being the compliant, okay, competitive, guy that I am, I was determined to check this assignment off my list like any other appointment. 5 minutes of doing nothing. I'd get it done. It took exactly 28 seconds before I started suffering serious withdrawal symptoms. Lists began unspooling in my mind of all the things I could be doing, all the things that needed doing, all the items that could have been checked off instead of this silly 5-minute exercise. I'm exaggerating slightly, but not by much. The reality is, I couldn't do it. I could not sit still for 5 minutes straight without doing something. Seriously, I could not sit still and do nothing for 5 minutes. If you're snickering to yourself thinking, "What a piece of cake," then you should try it. It's harder than you think. So I did what any hard-headed, slightly rebellious, type A workaholic would do. I blew off the weird exercise and returned to answering emails that had come in during the 1 minute and 38 seconds that I had wasted on such silliness and told myself that I didn't really have a problem. With newfound vigor, I returned to my normal life of producing, all the while neglecting the people and true priorities in my life. I don't have a problem. Do you? Healthy addictions. So I obviously flunked the counselor's 5-minute sit-still-and-do-nothing test. A week later, I found myself sitting across from him, imagining that I was handing him $1.50 for every minute that passed by, which I was, a thought that made me want to lose my lunch on his expensive carpet. "Since you're a pastor, would you consider yourself a person who has faith?" he asked me in his most condescending counselor tone. "Of course," I said in my most pedantic pastor tone. "I'm sure that's true," my new expensive friend continued. "But when it comes to your schedule, I'm guessing you really don't have much faith." Where is he going with this? As he continued, now in a much more soothing and compassionate tone, he started to make sense. "The biggest reason why many people surrender to the normal, overwhelmed, overly driven, unsustainable pace," he said slowly for effect, "is because we don't have faith. We don't honestly believe that God is on his throne, that he can and will handle the details of our lives, that he wants what's truly best for us, and that his way of doing life is better." What a weird way of looking at things. But could this be true? "We're afraid," my counselor continued, "that if we don't just run nonstop and try everything this world has to offer, we're going to miss out on something, We're afraid that we might miss that one thing that turns out to be the one elusive piece of our puzzle that will finally fill the void we feel so deeply. But nothing can. There's no such thing as a healthy addiction. Busted. He was dead on. This was exactly what I'd been doing. I'd been filling my life with things, more of those good, but not best, things that we looked at in the last chapter. I'd elevated my busyness to become an idol that endowed me with a keen sense of self-importance and entitlement. Just because I was addicted to God's work did not mean my fixation was healthy. As Tim Keller explains so well in his great book, Counterfeit Gods, idolatry is not just a failure to obey God, it is a setting of the whole heart on something besides God. We distract ourselves with being productive, which makes us look just like everyone else in the world. Our self-worth gets sucked into a riptide of bigger, better, best until we don't know how to break the cycle. A bigger house will make my spouse happy, so that will help my marriage. A nicer car will improve my self-image. Getting a promotion will enhance my lifestyle. A lot of important people are going to be at that meeting, so I need to be there too. I need my body to be as perfect as possible so people will notice me and think I'm attractive. I have to give my kids everything I never had, and I have to make sure they never miss an opportunity. Sick, destructive, harmful, but normal. Do you think your spouse would be happy if you lavished time and attention on him or her instead of being too busy to truly connect? What if, instead of the new expensive car that put you deeper in debt, causing you to push it more to make money, you had a reliable car, one that was completely paid for? What would that do for you? What if you got to do work that you loved, that was important and used your gifts, and God met your financial needs through it? What if you had deep and meaningful relationships with virtually everyone in your life, people you knew you could always count on, and they could always count on you? Isn't your spirit more important than your body? What if instead of trying to impress the other members at the gym, you looked after your health so you'll be there for your family? What if your kids learned the value of a dollar and the fulfillment of working for the things they want, instead of living with the normal sense of entitlement so common today? What if you invested as much time and energy into cultivating your kids' spiritual lives as you did in their vicariously fulfilling your dream of being a starting pitcher in the major leagues? If you feel you have to produce more and more and more to fill that vacuum inside you, make no mistake, it's idolatry. You're trying to substitute something for God when He's the only one who can fulfill you. This empty pursuit was exactly what I'd been doing for the majority of my life. I was wondering where my time was going instead of wondering where I was going in pursuit of God. And my counselor's prescription, as weird as it still might seem, is exactly what so many of us need today in order to be restored. We need rest. Strangely enough, often the antidote to idolatry is taking a Sabbath. Come to Jesus meeting. If you're addicted to busyness, to the physical thrill of an adrenaline rush because everything depends on your getting today's to-do list completed, then it's time for a come to Jesus meeting, literally. In Matthew 11:28-30, Jesus says, "Come to me, all you who are weary and burdened, and I will give you rest. Take my yoke upon you and learn from me, for I am gentle and humble in heart, and you will find rest for your souls. For my yoke is easy and my burden is light." Think about this. Jesus doesn't say he'll need you to work overtime, answer every email within 24 hours, or keep your home looking like Martha Stewart's. Jesus says he will give you rest for your souls. Deep internal rest and peace. When is the last time you were completely at rest? If you're like a lot of people, you may not even be sure what it feels like to be completely at rest. Experiencing real rest doesn't mean that you become lazy and unproductive. Take Jesus, for example. He was busy, but never hurried. He was productive, but never overwhelmed. He accomplished everything God wanted him to do, and still spent long, refreshing days in fellowship alone with his Father. Knowing when and how to rest is knowing when and how to acknowledge your limitations and your dependence on God. Too many of us live constantly with an ever-worsening sickness in our souls. This is the norm today: how you get ahead, how you know you're somebody, how you know you've arrived, by being exhausted on every level and stressed beyond imagination. Mounting pressures at work, chores at home, overdue projects, kids' activities, grocery shopping, repairs and maintenance, commitments, stress. Consider how weird it seems for someone to be calm, relaxed, at ease, and peaceful. We usually think such people are either on medication or need to be. Such weirdness dawned on me several years ago when my family was on vacation in the Rocky Mountains. On the drive from Oklahoma to Colorado, I was in my typical rushed, gotta get there mode. Timing myself on the highway, racing against who knows what, I strategically limited how much the kids could drink on stops to prevent bathroom breaks every 8 miles. With 6 kids, wouldn't you do the same thing? Once we arrived in Colorado, I felt pressure to make a plan. What would we do? How would we see it all? Which day would we do what? What's the best plan to maximize the trip? How will we know if we had a good time? On day 3, I decided to try my counselor's annoying 5-minute assignment that I'd failed before. Sitting on the balcony of our friend's condo, I paused to notice the mountain view along the horizon. Purple, orange, yellow sunlight reflected off the peaks. Red and blue wildflowers bobbing in the breeze of the grassy woodlands at the base of the Rockies. Wow! Nice work, God. Before long, I started to disconnect. My soul felt like it was thawing. My mind became quieter than I could remember in a long time. I could feel my heart rate start to slow and my breathing become deeper. Something was happening in my body. My senses seemed to heighten. I could feel the crisp mountain air as I noticed the smell of the distant pines. I saw an eagle soaring effortlessly in the distance. The white clouds seemed to be painted across the deep blue sky. Without realizing it, I punched off the internal time clock. 5 minutes turned to 10, and 10 to 20. My body relaxed as I came down from the adrenaline surge I'd grown accustomed to living on. This process took the rest of the day, as I seemed to unwind and unplug from all the stress that had held me hostage. The next day, the cool morning air made me feel more alive than I'd felt in months. The snow-capped mountains contrasting with the endless sky seemed like too much to take in. Rather than feeling rushed, I was at peace. Whose schedule were we on, anyway? Isn't that what a vacation is? Doing what you want to do when you feel like doing it? Instead of overwhelming me, the noise of my 6 kids brought me a deep sense of joy. Rather than worrying about work, schedules, and deadlines, I felt at peace with God. He was in control. The world at large would not crumble because I turned off my iPhone. This is how it's supposed to be. For the first time in who knows how long, I felt like myself, fully alive, fully present, and fully aware of God's goodness. Rest stop. Let's look again at Jesus' words in Matthew 11:28-30. Come to me, all you who are weary and burdened, and I will give you rest. Take my yoke upon you and learn from me, for I am gentle and humble in heart, and you will find rest for your souls. For my yoke is easy and my burden is light. Maybe you're overwhelmed. Maybe you're hurting. Maybe you're a single parent and you don't think you can make it another day. Maybe your business has collapsed and you're stretched. Jesus is calling you to him. Wouldn't you like rest for your soul? What if rest is not a luxury, but a necessity? As we discussed previously, when you get really busy, there's not enough time to get everything done. You certainly can't take a day off to rest. It's not unusual for people to work 6 or even 7 days a week. Even if their regular job is only 5 days a week, many people have another part-time job to make ends meet. If they don't, their days off are often spent catching up on chores, emails, or errands. We work harder to accumulate more stuff. Taking care of our stuff consumes most of our time. Pretty soon, there's no time left for doing nothing, for relaxing, resting, and being fully present. Not too many years ago, many businesses were not open on Saturday, and none were open on Sundays. Now, not only is almost every retailer open 7 days a week, but also many are open 24 hours a day. God worked for 6 days, and, as you probably know, on the seventh day he rested. Right off the bat, first things first, the God of the universe, busy creating the earth, the sky, animals, plants, fish, man and woman, and everything else, sets an incredible precedent by setting aside time to rest. This was such a good idea that it led to one of the Ten Commandments. 6 days you shall labor and do all your work, but the seventh day is a Sabbath to the Lord your God. On it you shall not do any work. Exodus 20:9-10. In Leviticus 25:2-4, God told Moses, "The land itself must observe a Sabbath to the Lord. For 6 years sow your fields, and for 6 years prune your vineyards and gather their crops. But in the seventh year, the land is to have a Sabbath of rest, a Sabbath to the Lord." He told Moses they couldn't sow during that year. The land is to have a year of rest. Verse 5. Have you ever heard of a company that would take a year off every 6 years? No way. That's crazy. We have to make money. We have to produce. We can't miss all those opportunities. Many business owners and customers think it's weird enough when a Christian-owned company like Chick-fil-A closes on Sundays. Yet they remain one of the most profitable fast food corporations, as well as one of the most respected, in the world. Their corporate leaders understand this basic principle that God first gave to the Israelites. By letting the land lie fallow, they allowed depleted nutrients to restore themselves. This even seemed weird to the Israelites, since they didn't have county extension agents to perform agricultural soil testing. God revealed the right thing for them to do, asking them to trust Him on faith. Today, farmers usually rotate crops that draw out different nutrients and utilize chemical restoration, so they never have to let the land sit fallow. We don't even know how to rest anymore. Most of us take vacations packed with traveling, activities, and money worries. Then we come back from our vacation needing a vacation. I took a staycation last year. You know, when you take your vacation time from work but stay at home. So I took a few days off to spend with my family. On the first day, I woke up early, my mind racing with important church matters. I quietly slipped into my home office and shifted easily into work mode. At about 8:30, Bookie, my 7-year-old coup plotter, found me at my desk as if he knew what had to be done if this staycation thing was going to work. He ran in, flexed his muscles, pointed at me, and called me out. "Dad, I'm going to whip you. Let's wrestle." More of the busy parent's creed. "I can't yet, buddy. I'll come out in a few minutes. Daddy's doing something important right now." Even as the words left my lips, God seared my heart. "Bookie is what's important. Your work is the distraction. Close your computer. Don't miss this moment." Most of us think we're too busy or too important to rest for a day. "Do you have any idea how important I am? I can't just let things go." When you say this, even if not aloud but in your heart, what you're saying is that God's principles are not true. You don't believe God. You don't believe He knows what's best for you, that rest will make you more productive and more spiritually healthy. You need some faith, and you probably need to take a nap. Sunday Schooled. In today's world, for many people, Sunday is just a normal day, another day at work, another day of the weekend for chores and errands, a day to sleep until noon and watch football. Or it could be the busiest day of the week because you and your family spend it going to and coming from church. Although I hope worshiping at church is a life-giving part of your week, I know that it can also be very time and energy consuming, especially for parents. But just as your body needs rest, your soul needs time to rest in God, to learn more about Him, to talk to Him, to worship and praise Him, to fellowship with other brothers and sisters. Remember Chariots of Fire, the powerful movie about legendary British athlete and Christian missionary Eric Liddell? When Liddell, Britain's Olympic star sprinter at the 1924 Olympics, found out that the first 100-meter race was on Sunday, he decided immediately that he could not run the race. Sunday is God's day, and he was committed to honoring it. Just because he was in Paris to compete in the Olympics didn't justify changing his lifelong commitment. Most normal people today would think him more than just weird. They would think him foolish for passing up a chance at personal glory and international acclaim. Many in Liddell's country called him a traitor for his bold and unusual stand. Even the Prince of Wales begged him to change his mind. But this uncommon man made an uncommon stand. In the next race, the 400 meters, not run on a Sunday, Liddell beat the runner-up by an amazing 15 meters. He won the Olympic gold and set a new world record. Though he could have done almost anything with his life after this success, Eric and his family moved back to China to serve as missionaries. Though many would scoff and dismiss his decision as weird, I suspect God would applaud louder than anyone who saw him win the gold medal. What if you made Sunday worship a non-negotiable and stuck to it as stubbornly as Eric Liddell did? Or if not Sunday, then one particular consistent day that's designated to focus on your relationship with God and with others and nothing else. What if you decided that if you were in town and not sick, you'd join other believers to corporately worship God? Sound a bit extreme? Extreme measures bring extreme results. If you want a normal life, do what normal people do. If you want to know God intimately, walk with Him daily, and please Him in every way, you're going to have to do what few do. Absolutely nothing. If you're addicted to your schedule and accomplishments, it's time to do something drastic to break out. If your iPad is your idol, it's time to put it down. To be fully alive, you need time with God to recharge. Get weird. Normal is not working. You need to rest. You need deep rest. If you are like normal people, you can't keep up this pace. It's time to make a change. Don't settle for a normal life. Not when you can enjoy the wonderful weirdness of being who God created you to be. Part 2. Chapter 4. Rich Relatives. We are rich only through what we give, and poor only through what we refuse. Ralph Waldo Emerson. When you were growing up, who was the richest person you knew? When I was little, the boy who set the gold standard for defining what it meant to be rich was a fabulously wealthy little kid named Richie Rich, star of his own comic book and Saturday morning cartoon. I don't remember how he got his money. Oil and gas? .com? Weekly allowance? But I do remember he had a butler and a robot maid, which still sounds pretty cool, if you ask me. How about today? Who embodies for you now what it means to be rich? Most of us know someone we consider to be rich. The successful entrepreneur, the hedge fund tycoon, the girl you went to high school with who wrote the bestseller that got made into the big movie starring Jennifer Aniston, who's also rich. If you're like me, chances are that at some point you've thought, if I were rich like them, I'd be a better rich person than they are. They spend their money on stupid stuff. I'd never do that. I'd only spend my money on good stuff, the right things, ways to help other people. Problem is, there's someone reading this book right now who's thinking the same thing about you. They would consider you rich and think that they would do a better job spending your money than you do. And they might be right. Being rich not only involves having rich relatives who leave you a bundle. Being rich is always relative to a shifting standard. When I was young, I believed that if you worked hard, you could make enough money to be considered at least regular rich. If you worked hard and had some lucky breaks along the way, then maybe you'd become really rich. And if you worked hard, fell into some great luck, and were beautiful or good-looking enough to marry a gazillionaire, you might even make it a mega mucho buy whatever you want and never worry about it rich. No matter where you rank on the scale, though, chances are that if you're like most people, you'd rather be on the next level higher. Normally, we're never satisfied. Have you noticed that many rich people don't seem to believe they're rich? I have some wealthy friends. If I took you over to their house to meet them, you'd say, "Yeah, they're loaded." Then I could take you to their other two homes, and you'd think, "They are really loaded." But whenever someone tells them they're rich, they say, "Oh no, we're not rich. We know these other people who, now, they're rich." My friends don't think they're rich, because they know someone who's richer. The University of Warwick in the UK recently completed a study they called Money and Happiness: Rank of Income, Not Income, Affects Life Satisfaction. As the study's title suggests, their research concluded that for most people, to feel happy about how much money they have, it has to be more than what their friends and colleagues have. This turned out to be true no matter how much money someone makes. As long as they know someone who earns more, they aren't satisfied that they are really well off. What they have isn't enough, no matter how much it is. Comparative wealth. Honestly, these results didn't surprise me. The writer of Ecclesiastes observes, "Whoever loves money never has money enough. Whoever loves wealth is never satisfied with his income." Chapter 5, verse 10. Talk about timeless. This statement about sums up the normal mindset of people in our culture today. Whatever we have isn't enough. There's always more to earn, spend, buy, shop for, save for, luxuriate in, and go into debt for. The only way to know you're rich is if you can't find anyone who can count higher. This comparative standard of wealth is further complicated by the fact that the vast majority of us don't consider ourselves anywhere near being rich. If someone asked me, "Craig, are you wealthy?" I'd say, "Are you kidding? I'm a pastor. God provides, of course, but we're far from loaded." My response would be normal. Roughly 98% of Americans consider themselves not rich, and roughly 98% of people in developing countries would consider America's poor to be rich. Most of us tend to lump ourselves into this not rich category, even though we've all seen people who are, without question, living on much less than we have. And certainly, there are also people who are certifiably rich whether they choose to believe it or not. We've all seen millionaires, and we've all encountered homeless people on city streets, and most of us would identify ourselves somewhere in between. Because cultural and individual standards of wealth are relative, the definition of rich always dangles out in front of us. No one seems to know where the true starting line for being rich is located. Why is that true? It's because rich is a moving target. How you defined rich years ago may not be your standard today. My personal notion of wealth has evolved with each new life season. For example, when I was making $24,000 a year as a pastor, I had a friend who was making $40,000 a year. I distinctly remember telling Amy, "If we could ever make $40,000 a year, we'd never need more than that as long as we live. We'd be rich." Then, of course, we had a child. Then we liked that one so much, we had five more. Rich moved and left no forwarding address. The Gallup organization recently polled North Americans, asking them how much annual income they'd need to consider themselves rich. People making $30,000 a year or less answered, on average, $74,000 a year. People making around $50,000 a year told Gallup they'd need $100,000 a year to be rich. Virtually no one responded in a way that indicated their present annual income as the benchmark for being rich. Yes, the six-figure mark. Surely that's an accurate indicator of being rich, right? Viewed objectively as a rich threshold crossing number, $100,000 certainly makes sense. However, some of you reading this right now are already qualifying such a definition. Is that gross or net? Before or after taxes? With or without insurance? And mortgage payment? And car payments? And you get the picture. Couples with a combined income of $100,000 a year might say, I've got news for you. That's not rich. With property taxes and a mortgage and kids in college and braces and soccer camp and car insurance and breast implants for my wife, $100,000 a year doesn't go very far. Another study asked top income earners in the United States how much they'd need to have in assets to feel rich. The most common response? A cool $5 million. If you asked someone with only $2 million, are you rich? She'd say, are you kidding? No, I'm not rich. Rich is a moving target, which explains why normal Americans, even though we're far better off than most people in the world, don't feel rich. Therefore, we're never satisfied, always wanting more and never appreciating all that we've been given. Once again, being normal is killing us. Living like the other half. Calling what I'm about to tell you good news doesn't do it justice. It's better than good news. It's unbelievably great news. Ready? Maybe you should sit down. Here goes. The good news is, you really are rich. Yes, I'm talking to you. No one's reading over your shoulder. And before you roll your eyes and think, oh boy, here we go with a pastoral, you're so much richer than starving people in undeveloped countries guilt trip, let me stop you. I'm not here to guilt you into giving an extra $20 to the local food pantry or foreign missions team, although I think both are great causes and could definitely use a few more 20s, or to make you feel bad because you're all warm and cozy, or cool and breezy, depending on where you live, in your nice house with lots of nutritious food in the cupboard and a 42-inch flat screen on the wall. No, my good news for you is that you have opportunities other people don't have. You're rich because you have rich people opportunities. You can provide amazing opportunities for your kids to learn, to grow, and to enjoy life. You can have birthday parties for them, take them out to eat, and put them in sports or music lessons. You have reliable transportation that you control. You might be rich enough that you willingly pay so your kids can go to a particular school for an extraordinary education. You might even take your family on annual vacations to places like the beach, the mountains, museums, and, heck, even Disneyland. Yep, you're rich. And because God has entrusted you with such riches, you can use these resources to make a profound difference in countless lives. This is very, very good news, even better than winning the lottery. More good news is that if you have work that you actually like and you're enjoying blessings in this life, both of those things are gifts directly from God. We're told, when God gives any man wealth and possessions and enables him to enjoy them, to accept his lot and be happy in his work, this is a gift of God. Ecclesiastes 5:19. This verse makes it so obvious. God has blessed you. You're doubly rich. Now, I realize that you may not be feeling particularly rich at the moment. Our relationship with money is tied to our life circumstances. How we feel about relative wealth is contextual at any given time. You might be hurting financially after enduring a nasty divorce. As if having your heart ripped out and trampled weren't enough, it also left you in a financial mess. You may have fought a major illness and survived its challenges, only to find yourself now facing a mountain of bills so high you can't see the future beyond them. You might be a single parent with a low-paying job, a deadbeat ex, a bad credit rating, and a car you've raised to life 6 times. I know a lot of people who are going through circumstances just like these, and they'd say, you know, I sure don't feel rich. Fair enough. I also know plenty of people in these same situations who complained about what they can't afford, even as they're watching cable on their high-def TV and eating piping hot pizza just delivered to their front door, ordered on their iPhone, the one with the unlimited texting and data plan. If we're honest, most of us are doing okay. Living large. Since normal people don't believe they're rich, they generally skim through or skip past anything the Bible says to wealthy people. If you come across a Bible passage that's directly aimed at the rich, how do you respond? From my experience, most of us would say, "Yes, absolutely. Those rich people really need to hear God's word. I'll sure remember this verse if I ever become rich." However, we must remember, God's timeless word is for the whole planet. When we compare ourselves with the rest of the world, we have to acknowledge that He's talking to us today. We are those rich people. Visiting a small settlement in a developing country last year, I was struck by the way one of the villagers shared his knowledge of the world beyond his homeland. Since more than half the world lives on less money than most Americans pay for cable TV, you can only imagine how they might describe us. Many would likely say, "There are some people who are so rich, they own a car." It's not a lot of people, of course. I read it's only 3 to 5% of the people in the world who own a car. But some people in the world are so rich, they have 2 cars. Some of these people even have a house for their cars. It's called a garage, and it's like a little house to protect their cars from the elements. You know what else they do? These rich people, they get in their cars, and they drive past 20 or more food places. They call them restaurants. And they're so rich that they pay other people to make their food and serve it to them. That's how rich they are. Some of these rich people eat so much food in so many restaurants that they get fat, but keep eating more and more. Then they have to go to these places called gyms, and they pay people to help them exercise. That's how rich they are. Some of these rich people have special rooms at home called closets. This little room inside their house is just for their clothes. Nobody sleeps in there, only clothes on hangers and shelves like in a store. Some people are so rich, they even have 1 big clothes room for the man and 1 for the woman. So many clothes, some for hot, some for cold, some for work, and some for church. It's crazy. That's how rich people live. I've never seen that with my own eyes. No, but I've heard about it. Okay, so my new friend didn't go on, but I couldn't help but see our culture through his eyes. In fact, since approximately 50% of the world's population lives on less than $2 a day, any one of nearly 3 billion people could have easily said everything you just heard. Rich is relative, and we lose sight of how wealthy we really are when we focus only on what we see on TV, in movies, and in magazines. So why don't we feel rich? All-consuming. So we're rich, but we don't feel rich. How is this possible? It's all because of M&Ms, mass media, and mass marketing. Some advertisers want us to feel rich if we can afford their products. They're often called luxury brands and include Mercedes automobiles, Cartier jewelry, and Ralph Lauren clothing. Other marketers want us to feel proud of how cost-conscious and value-minded we are as smart shoppers. They want us to view their products not as a luxury, but as the best quality for the lowest price. Think Walmart, Hyundai, and Old Navy. In either case, we're still encouraged to buy, spend, and shop some more. That's what normal people do. Sadly, such a mindset does not honor God. If you're a follower of Jesus, He has given you abundance so that you can care for others, not so you can stock up on capri pants for next summer or afford a leather interior in the new SUV. As long as you don't own the responsibility of being blessed with resources so that you can give to those around you, then you can stay focused on getting more for yourself. But God's word and the example Jesus set for us make it Waterford crystal clear. It's not about us. We find our lives when we give them away. As long as we live in pursuit of more stuff, the latest eye toy or coolest shoes, or rely on status symbols to define us, despite the name, a new pair of true religion jeans won't get us any closer to God. We will never live in true abundance. We must go from the normal mindset about money and wealth to a radically weird view. Gratitude for all we have, and stewardship of its use for the good of all. This shift requires us to break out of our usual consumer framework and place ourselves within a global perspective. If you earn $37,000 a year, you're in the top 4% of all wage earners alive today, certifiably rich by anyone's definition. If you make $45,000 a year or more, you're in the top 1% of wage earners in the world. In order to honor God with your wealth, you first have to admit that you are rich. Most people won't do that. It's not normal. True prosperity. Just because I'm pointing out how rich we are and how we're supposed to live accordingly, I hope you don't think I'm teaching what's known as the prosperity gospel. This set of beliefs is based on the idea that God wants us to be wealthy and successful, as evidenced by our bank account and possessions, and all we have to do is follow certain biblical principles to make it happen. If you do X for God, He'll give you Y in return. When people ask me how I regard the prosperity gospel, my response is always the same. God blesses each of us with a variety of gifts. He's already prospered us. The real issue is, how do we honor Him with what we've been given? Maybe I'm so passionate about this topic because ever since I was a kid, I've struggled with the fear that there's not going to be enough. Not enough time in the day, not enough milk in the fridge, not enough toilet paper in the bathroom, and not enough money in the bank. This mindset has been ingrained in me most of my life, and it absolutely affects the way I think. Foremost, this fear has shaped how I handle money. We've always lived beneath our means. Weird as it may seem, we never finance anything. We save for the items we want to buy, and we set aside savings for unexpected expenses. I always secretly prided myself on how frugal and responsible I was with money. Several people over the years have asked, "Craig, how did you get so good at managing finances? How are you so disciplined about saving money?" They view it as a superhuman feat of self-discipline and brilliant planning. It's good to stay out of debt and save for a rainy day, right? Then one day, I realized that my motivation was totally fear-based, not God-honoring. Even though I was handling money responsibly, I was still putting my security in my own abilities to earn and control money so that I would never have to go without anything again. My hope was in material wealth rather than in God's rich provision. At this realization, I was reminded of 1 Timothy 6:17 through 19. "Command those who are rich in this present world not to be arrogant, nor to put their hope in wealth, which is so uncertain, but to put their hope in God, who richly provides us with everything for our enjoyment. Command them to do good, to be rich in good deeds, and to be generous and willing to share. In this way, they will lay up treasure for themselves as a firm foundation for the coming age, so that they may take hold of the life that is truly life." What's in your wallet? My point is that even if we think we're handling money in a biblical way, our real motive may not be pleasing to God. He wants our hearts focused on Him, not on imagining every worst-case financial scenario and saving accordingly. Until we identify and face our heart's attitude toward money, we'll never be able to acknowledge our riches. And until we can realize how rich we truly are, we'll continue to struggle with sharing, giving, and serving others with our resources. So maybe the question is not, what's in your wallet, but what's in your heart? This is basically the question Jesus posed to the richy rich of His day. This very wealthy young man came to Him and asked how he could be closer to God. Jesus essentially said, "You're going to have to let go of your stuff if you want to be different, if you want to follow Me." The guy said, "I can't do that. I love my stuff too much." I'm paraphrasing a little. This scene emerges from Luke 18:18-30. Jesus looked at him and said, "How hard is it for the rich to enter the kingdom of God? Indeed, it is easier for a camel to go through the eye of a needle than for a rich man to enter the kingdom of God." Verses 24-25. Now, I wasn't a physics major in college, but I know how big a camel is. and I know how tiny the eye of a needle is. Jesus said it's harder for us, the rich people, to enter God's kingdom than it is for a camel to go through the eye of a needle. You don't need to know the original Greek to understand that he means it's hard, really hard. Why in the world would Jesus say that rich people have an extra difficult time entering God's kingdom? Was he just like everyone else who resents the rich for having more than him? I don't think so. Instead, I believe he's simply making an observation, not a judgment. It's not that a camel's bad behavior prevents it from sliding through that hole in a needle. No, the animal's physical size prevents it. Similarly, the more a person is able to control life through the power of money, wealth, and status, the more inclined he is to rely on his money's abilities to make things happen instead of relying on God. It's so hard for us rich people, yes, he's talking to you and me as much as that rich young ruler, to see Jesus, to get him, to believe in him, because honestly, we just don't need to rely on him that much. We think our greatest strength is our stuff, our annual salary, our savings account, our credit limit. What if, weirdly enough, our greatest spiritual disadvantage is all this same stuff? Possessions, dollars, material items. Make no mistake, we're rich, and as I see it, being rich brings with it three main challenges. 1. Being rich makes it harder to depend on God. Most of us in the United States have never had to pray, "Jesus, give me bread today." I know this isn't true of everyone, but it is true of most. Why? Because you've always had a pantry full of bread, or Twinkies, or nacho cheese Doritos. You've never really known what it's like to trust God to provide for you today, because you've got today provided for, and probably tomorrow too, maybe even into next winter with all the food stocked away in that extra freezer in the garage. I know some people who are doing so well at managing their resources that not only are they doing fine not relying on God, but also they've made sure their kids will never have to depend on Him either. They have insurance, health care, retirement, and plenty of other safety nets. It's the norm, right? Having these things isn't bad and can be very wise, but they often impede our ability to trust God with our needs. 2. Being rich distracts you from true priorities. Because you're rich, you'll have all sorts of opportunities. You can travel at will. You certainly don't need a church family. You have season football tickets, so you have a valid reason to skip church from September until January. I know people who won't come to church in the summer because they are at their lake house instead. If you are like many, you're rich enough to have your kid in organized sports, and you have to take him to another state because even though he's only 9 now, you never know, he might just go pro one day. You don't really get to pour into your kids because the only time you have together is in the car chauffeuring them between dance, soccer, karate, field hockey, football, gymnastics, glee club, ice skating practice, scuba lessons, and Hooked on Phonics class. And as if all that weren't enough, you have to work harder, not just to pay all the activity fees and buy all the uniforms, but also to keep all the cars and air conditioners and sprinkler systems running. You're distracted with all of your normal rich problems. If you've never traveled to a third world country, I'd really encourage you to visit sometime, preferably on a mission where you actually get to serve the people who live there. Every time I go, I see people who literally have nothing. I'm talking nothing, like not even a floor, nothing, like living on dirt, nothing, like no indoor toilet, nothing. Like, we don't know if we'll be eating today, nothing. They're different. They're, well, weird. Really weird. Weirder than anyone I've ever known, weird. So many of these people, all they have is Jesus and each other. It freaks me out every time how full their lives feel, despite how little they seem to have that we would consider essential. I find myself strangely jealous of their joy, peace and simplicity, until I get back home, that is. Then I find myself right back on my iPad, thinking that all the things I've surrounded myself with are key to my happiness. 3. being rich gives you greater responsibility. Why do you think God made you rich? Do you honestly believe it was so you could consume it all? A normal response. But Luke 12:48 says, "From everyone who has been given much, much will be demanded, and from the one who has been entrusted with much, much more will be asked." Much has been given to us. Because God made us rich, He expects far more from us. How then should we live as rich people? I'm glad you asked. It's time for Lifestyles of the Rich and Weird for Jesus. Chapter 5. The Best Money Can't Buy. Debt is the worst poverty. Thomas Fuller. I just got off the phone with a close friend who was suffocating financially. 7 years ago, Jim and his family purchased a comfortably nice three-bedroom home. After they moved in, his wife wanted a new kitchen table and up-to-date wallpaper and drapes, and he wanted, every man's dream, a new gas grill and outside storage unit to house his new riding lawnmower. One thing led to another: new countertops, new carpet, new stainless steel appliances, all compliments of MasterCard and Visa. Reminds me of one of my daughter's favorite stories, If You Give a Mouse a Cookie, in which we learn that mice are an awful lot like people when it comes to always wanting more, whether it be more cookies or more nice things. Jim and Beth's lifestyle overflowed with signs of beauty, charm, and good taste. They had a nice house, a nice car, nice clothes, and nice opportunities for their two growing and talented children. Then one day, unexpectedly, they found out they were expecting. You might have guessed it. Their new baby added fuel to the new and better consumer credit fire that was already burning. Before long, it became obvious that their current vehicle and house would be cramped by another child, leading overnight to borrowing for a newer and larger SUV and new and larger house with four bedrooms instead of three to make sure they had plenty of room for their surprise blessing. Jim told me painfully, "I don't know what happened. Everything seemed like the right thing to do at the time. We needed a larger house. We wanted a safe vehicle for our baby. And I don't know how we could take our daughter out of dance and cheering or our son out of soccer and baseball. Isn't it normal for parents to want to give their kids the best?" As I listened to him recount each financial decision he'd made, his story sounded like many others you and I have both heard. Now that he'd lost his job, he was worried he might also lose his house. Jim looked at me and concluded with hollow resolve, "Well, at least I know that my problems are normal problems." Priceless. You want to know something that's perfectly normal in how we view money? Stress from not having enough money, not making enough money, and owing way too much money. So many people I know live paycheck to paycheck. With the recent economic struggles we've had, you may be in the same boat. According to a recent survey by CareerBuilder.com, more than half, 61%, of working Americans live paycheck to paycheck. Monthly payments? Normal. Credit card debt? Normal. Paying only the monthly minimums? Normal. Yes, in fact, it's priceless. Because what price can you play on your worry, anxiety, and fear? How much are your health, security, and peace of mind worth? Since everyone fights this battle, though, surely it's worth the war, right? It's only normal. All we want is what we think everyone else has. But everyone else has only the same stress, worry, and despair that we have. And the collateral damage of all this normalcy? Tension in your relationships with the people you love the most. Fights between you and your spouse. Feelings of helplessness and frustration, powerlessness and despair, shame and embarrassment. Since it's been at least a few minutes since I've brought it up, you know why I'm so against being normal? Normal does not work. How many of us typically spend more each month than we earn? And how do we cover the gap? Credit cards, depleted savings, payday loans, and early 401k withdrawals. What would it be like to have money left over at the end of the month? To pay all your bills and save money? Please don't hear me passing judgment or feeling superior. I shared earlier how my frugality and commitment to living debt-free were really just the flip side of this same shiny coin, wanting to feel in control of my life. The problem with keeping the focus on ourselves and spending all or more than we earn is that we miss out on the blessing of giving it away to others. I know. You may be saying, I don't have enough to get by on myself. How can I worry about giving to anyone else? Most people say the reason they don't give more is that they don't feel they can afford it. They feel they don't have enough. What if you had enough to say, oh, I don't know, help someone in need? What if you had enough extra money available that you could give some away and not feel stressed about it? What if you had enough money available to do what you enjoy most? What if you even had enough money available that you could exchange some of it for more time in your schedule? For example, say you could pay someone to clean your house or take care of your yard. Extra financial oxygen gives you more room to breathe. It can help you feel rested, not anxious, worried, and always afraid. You know, like normal. Considering what a destructive distraction money troubles can be, it's not surprising that God wants you free from financial worry. He wants you to have extra. Proverbs 21:20 is a great verse to memorize. In the house of the wise are stores of choice food and oil, but a foolish man devours all he has. The wise, not the rich, have more than enough in their house. They have extra. According to this verse, it's a foolish person who lives paycheck to paycheck. Every time he gets more, he uses it all up. Don't you think it's weird that the Bible doesn't say you have to be wealthy to have more than enough? According to this verse, you don't have to be a two-income family. You don't need six figures annually. You only have to be wise. There's a wise way to manage the money God entrusts to you, and there's a foolish way to mismanage what God entrusts to you. The choice is really yours. Richer than rich. Some good friends of ours, two different families, have very different homes. I'm guessing both couples are similar to people you know. Mike and his wife, Brenda, live like many of the people in our local community. They have a beautiful 4,000-plus square foot home. Their yard is manicured, professionally cared for. The massive entryway into their house features double doors opening off a long, beautiful porch. Even their doorbell is awesome. It's not just ding-dong, it's dong-da-ding-da-dong-dong. Walking in, I always feel like I'm entering a hotel. The impression is immediately tasteful, inviting, open, grand. High ceilings, wood floors bordering expensive tile, a prominent curvy staircase. The kitchen shimmers with stainless steel appliances. My wife envies their expensive gas stove, not to mention the water spout perfect for pot filling right next to it. Granite countertops everywhere. Every room exudes their expensive good taste, even the bathrooms. Marble vanities and antique-looking fixtures. The toilet is huge and so high up that when you sit on it, your feet dangle like a little kid's, not that mine have. Their garage, if you could call it that, looks more like a giant showroom with shiny cars in it. Lined with storage cabinets, it has four bays. Brenda has a big SUV. Mike has a fully loaded, very classy sedan, so he can chauffeur clients around when they're in town. They also have a flashy, bright convertible, just for fun. The remaining bay holds their ski boat and the kids' twin Sea-Doos. Their whole house sends a clear message. Mike and Brenda are enviously successful. They're doing well, very well. It's so obvious that not only do they have a lot of money, way more than they need, but also they have good taste and cool insider's knowledge about the best stuff their money can buy. But Mike let me in on what their successful lifestyle is costing them, much, much more than any dollar amount. You see, they're honestly not doing so great. Behind the granite, marble, and hardwood floors, They don't really have any financial means, no margin whatsoever. Brenda recently had to return to work. She wanted to stay home and take care of their kids in the house, but that's just not a realistic option anymore. Mike's constantly afraid he's going to lose his job. They're in a desperate race, grasping to maintain their lifestyle. Both of them are constantly tired, overextended, and afraid. They snipe and snap at each other more and more, just as the late fees and overdraft charges pile up more and more. I'm convinced they do love each other, but they blame each other for their circumstances, and you can see it in how they vent their frustration and fear on each other. Sure, their house has fantastic curb appeal, but you sure wouldn't want to live there. The writer of Proverbs 13:7 could have been describing their home when he said, "One man pretends to be rich, yet has nothing." Then there's Tony and Aaron. When you walk up to their house, the first thing you notice is their shabby, dandelion-infested yard. Cluttered with toys and footprints, it looks as if every kid in the neighborhood lives there, and they practically do. You can push the doorbell if you like, but it doesn't work. When I knock on the cheap, flimsy screen door, Tony always gives me a hard time about it. "Your family! If it's unlocked," which it always is, "then come on in." The narrow entryway is dimly lit, but the ceilings will take your breath away. That is, provided you're a fan of that 70s-style popcorn texturing. The kitchen is small and sparse, but really functional. When you come in, Aaron, quite the cook, grabs you. "Try this. You'll love it," she says, smiling, as she shoves a spoon in your mouth. And she's always right. Soup or spaghetti sauce or something fruity. It's delicious, and you instantly want more. The countertops are genuine formica. A bit faded and even cracked in a few spots, but great for leaning on or spilling Kool-Aid on or chopping vegetables for Aaron's next creation. Their bathroom has just one sink, one toilet, and one bathtub. But there's something cozy and charming about it. Aaron is an artist, so she's made little towels that read, "Welcome, Love, and Friends." Although not as small as their bathroom, the garage is seriously tiny. They have two cars, both with more than 100,000 miles, and one with considerably more than that, but only one car fits in there. Tony's older, little car that could stays outside like a devoted pet, shamelessly braving the elements. I absolutely love coming to their house, and I tell them this almost every visit. It feels like, well, home. I kick my shoes off right inside the front door and just hang out in my socks. Their soft couch practically begs me to crash for a nap on it. Maybe it sounds weird. I'm sure you've become accustomed to this from me by now. But it feels like I live there. It's so peaceful. It hums and breathes and whispers to slow down, relax, be yourself. You can feel it everywhere. They have plenty of money, more than they need. Nobody ever goes hungry there, especially not guests. Tony and Aaron have chosen a simpler lifestyle. When I fall into their old recliner to watch a game with Tony on their smallish 36-inch television and see how they and their kids all interact with each other, they're different. They're not just family. They actually seem to enjoy each other, to want to be around one another and share things together. Crazy, I know. Downright weird. They don't have a lot of nice things or photo shoot-ready rooms staged with new furniture, so they don't really care if something accidentally gets broken. You can't imagine the peace there. Eating a sandwich over their sink is more therapeutic than getting a massage. No tension, fear, and anxiety. No pressure to focus more on their stuff than on them. The casual observer approaching their house would say, "They are so out of it. Did you see all those dog hairs? And the furniture, not to mention that non-hip retro original wallpaper. Shame they can't afford better." But they'd be dead wrong. The problem isn't that they can't afford what many would consider better. The problem is that we've been defining better, rich, successful, cool, acceptable, the wrong way. Mike and Brenda's huge house, with its picture-perfect rooms, reeks with tension, frustration, and fear. It offers nothing to make guests feel secure, relaxed, at ease. No, the whole vibe in that house whispers instead, this is illusion, a house of cards about to fall. Tony and Aaron's home, on the other hand, creates a kind of envy that can't be quenched by a trip to Ethan Allen. Their home is rich in love, brimming with margin, with room to make mistakes, and time to just hang out. Their family has what matters most. In the house of the wise are stores of choice food and oil, but a foolish man devours all he has. Proverbs 21:20. Again, I'm not trying to judge my friends, but I know because of what each couple has shared with me. One works hard to prop up an illusion that sucks the life out of them, and the other works hard to make their home a place that restores them, nurtures them, and gives life to others. Contentment for Dummies. It seems like we can always count on Paul to make things obvious for us. In 1 Timothy 6:6-8, he writes, "Godliness with contentment is great gain, for we brought nothing into the world, and we can take nothing out of it. But if we have food and clothing, we will be content with that." Tony and Aaron embody this kind of contentment. They're godly with contentment, holy with their homemaking. Not a little gain, not just some gain, not, "Ah, shucks, we're just poor, humble people getting by." No, great gain. They're deliberately choosing their lifestyle, just as Mike and Brenda chose theirs. Paul goes on in verses 9 and 10 to describe the painful cycle so many people find themselves in. People who want to get rich fall into temptation and a trap and into many foolish and harmful desires that plunge men into ruin and destruction. For the love of money is a root of all kinds of evil. Some people, eager for money, have wandered from the faith and pierced themselves with many griefs. It's the foundation of Temptation 101. It looks so good, but it's a trap. Just listen to how serious, downright dangerous, his words are. Trap. Foolish. Harmful. Plunge. Ruin. Destruction. All kinds of evil. Pierced. Griefs. What are some of the griefs piercing the normal people we know? Debt, financial pressure, stress, tension, and over what? Money? In Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, I love what Charlie's grandpa tells him when Charlie wants to sell his golden ticket because their family really needs the money. "There's plenty of money out there. They print more every day. But this ticket, there's only 5 of them in the whole world, and that's all there's ever going to be. Only a dummy would give this up for something as common as money. Are you a dummy?" Godliness with contentment is rare. It's weird. All of us know people who can't enjoy the blessings that God has provided to them because they're always worried about money. That's common. And why does it stress them so much? Because they're so desperate to keep it all. That's the fear, isn't it? That you'll have to give some up? Have to lose some of that great stuff that goes along with it. Maybe the reason why clinging to it all feels so stressful is because we're not supposed to. There's plenty of money. If you want to be different, if you want to be better than normal, then you must live differently. This is the one life that God has given you. According to the gospel of Charlie's grandfather, only a dummy would give it up for something as common as money. The secret to debt-free living in 4 easy payments. If you've ever suffered insomnia and spent the wee hours of the morning channel surfing, you know that many people are getting rich by telling the rest of us how to get out of debt. Or if you've cruised through the bestsellers at your local Barnes & Noble, you can also find an entire section devoted to the secrets of debt-free living. Now, I'm not talking about the legitimate financial experts who have sound principles and inspiring methods of being fiscally responsible. I'm a big Dave Ramsey fan, and there are many other excellent resources that I would endorse wholeheartedly. My problem with some of the other financial gurus is that they clearly seem to be exploiting our desire for a quick fix. I hate to shout out the obvious here, but none of us dug our debt pit overnight. My friends Jim and Beth, as well as Brenda and Mike, didn't set out to fall head over heels in debt. It was that one thing leads to another trap. If you give a mouse a cookie, he wants a glass of milk. Enough is never enough. Most of us have lifestyled our way right into the black pit of normal. It feels like it's an income problem. Most people think, if only I made just a little more money, it wouldn't take much, then I could fix everything going on in my life. But it's not an income problem. It's a lifestyle problem. As your income goes up, your lifestyle trails along and catches up, gobbling up with it any chance you have at extra. At its root, it's actually more than just a lifestyle problem. It's a spiritual problem. In Matthew 6:19, Jesus says, "Do not store up for yourselves treasures on earth, where moth and rust destroy, and where thieves break in and steal." But most people's lifetime ambition is the exact opposite of that. Store and get more. More, more, more. Jesus continues, "Store up for yourselves treasures in heaven, where moth and rust do not destroy, and where thieves do not break in and steal. For where your treasure is, there your heart will be also." Verses 20 through 21. Where your money goes, there your heart follows. The average Christian in the United States gives about 2% of his or her income toward helping people and advancing God's kingdom on the earth. That means that the remaining 98% goes to the world, which means that 98% of our hearts go toward the world. If you catch yourself wondering why you want more of the world and you're not satisfied with God, it's because you have a spiritual problem. We think that more is going to make us happy. 1 John 2:15 through 17 gives us fair warning. "Do not love the world or anything in the world. If anyone loves the world, the love of the Father is not in him. For everything in the world, the cravings of sinful man, the lust of his eyes, and the boasting of what he has and does, comes not from the Father, but from the world. The world and its desires pass away, but the man who does the will of God lives forever." If you want to get out of debt forever, the secret is that there's no secret. It's like losing weight. No matter how many fad diets or gimmicks people come up with, there's no quick fix. You have to change the way you eat. Less bad stuff and more good stuff. And you have to exercise. Overcoming debt is the same way. It's basic math. Fortunately, it's elementary math, not nuclear physics. The two options on the path to financial margin are simple. 1. Earn more. 2. Spend less. That's it. The secret to getting out of debt, right there in a nutshell. You knew that. And I trust you also know that I'm not trying to insult your intelligence or express anything other than encouragement about how to get out of the normal money trap that's killing so many people. So if we know the solution, what keeps us from implementing it? There has to be a deeper issue, a root problem. To get rid of a spiritual problem, we need to pull it up by its spiritual root. To pull up roots, we're going to have to be willing to get our hands dirty, to make some sacrifices that provide long-term benefits instead of short-term refinanced gains. God is willing to help us, to provide the tools we need to weed out those areas where our desire for money is spoiling our fruit of the Spirit. Proverbs 15:16 says, "Better to have little, with fear for the Lord, than to have great treasure and inner turmoil." New Living Translation. Better a little with God than a whole lot without Him. Better to have fewer houses, cars, appliances, clothes, toys, and bills than to have the whole world and lose your soul. Better something paid for that's used and enjoyed and shared and worn out than something nice and shiny and new that won't be paid for until 2019 and that you're too stressed to enjoy. Better a little with the fear of the Lord than more of what everyone else has. Better than normal instead of normal is best. The world says more will make you happy, but this is the mirage in the desert of 21st century life. You can never get there. God says happiness is contentment with what you already have, with what He provides you, with what you can share. If you struggle to believe this, then you must pierce the veil of illusion our culture works so hard to sustain. You must long for God more than normal. You must be willing to live to give, not live to gain. It's like Jesus asking the lame man beside the healing waters of Bethesda, "Do you want to get well?" John 5:6. Obviously, he wasn't insulting this invalid, who was clearly there intent on being healed. So do you want to be well? Do you want to escape from debt? Then you have to make a choice about what matters most and then act on your heart's desire. It's normal to be sick over money in our culture today. In order to be healthy and experience the joy of eternal riches, it's time to get weird.